Firstly, I'd like to say on behalf of AMP Capital, welcome along, and thank you very much indeed for selecting this session. Just very briefly, and I highlight that brevity on my behalf is critical, because you're not here to hear from me, you're here to hear from Paul Foster, who's totally responsible for the infrastructure area at AMP Capital. You're going to hear from Paul Foster. Paul Foster is the head of the portfolio management in the infrastructure team. And he's responsible for the portfolio construction and management of AMP Capital's seven major infrastructure portfolios. Might remember from the elevator pitch that a lot of this sort of type of investment, especially in the direct space that we have, has been a world unto the world of institutional investors. So there's some exciting developments there for that we're coming through in the retail world, and we'll talk about that later. And part of those portfolios include the Infrastructure Equity Fund, which we abbreviate to the IEF, and large single client mandates. Paul has collectively around about 16 years of financial markets and asset management experience across a variety of mainstream and alternative asset classes. So, as I mentioned, brevity is critical on my behalf. So without any further ado, please join me in welcoming Paul Foster.
All right, thanks, Simon. And thanks again for taking the time to come along and hear us this morning, because we know you do have some choices. I'm going to spend this morning talking about infrastructure investing. And the key message, I guess, that I hope to leave you with out of this talk this morning is this is a pretty interesting asset class, and infrastructure assets have some pretty interesting characteristics that we think create value for a portfolio. But the way you package up those assets into either unlisted or listed exposures is actually pretty key in defining whether those characteristics are preserved, how they're diluted, or how they're changed. And we'll go into that in a bit more detail. So, first of all, just a bit of backdrop into the asset class and its increased popularity over the last few years. We'll spend a little bit of time talking about what infrastructure is, and in terms of our investment philosophy, just as importantly, what infrastructure is not. And that becomes quite critical in defining the universe of opportunities that that do and don't fall into a potential portfolio that you're putting together. We'll then talk about this concept of packaging and the importance of the way you put together infrastructure assets in preserving some of the inherent characteristics of the asset class. We'll then show you some of the work that we're doing that illustrates or suggests that the way you combine unlisted and listed infrastructure exposures is actually a fairly efficient and interesting type of concept and strategy to consider for your clients' portfolios, particularly given some of the stability and low correlation that the asset class possesses inherently. And then hopefully we'll have some time for some questions. Infrastructure was really a cottage asset class, really up until the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, as an organised asset class, it really only began in the mid-1990s. There's been a lot of growth and a lot of interest in the asset class, both from a investor's side and a funds management side over the last few years, and that's evidenced by a few trends that I've outlined here on this slide, and we'll go into each of them in a bit more detail. The historical funders of private sector infrastructure investing have been the superannuation funds and pension funds. Again, firstly here in Australia, and in more recent years out of Europe and out of the United States and Canada, you've seen infrastructure investing become quite popular among pension fund investors for a variety of very good reasons. Extremely long duration asset, therefore very good match to long duration liability streams that most of these pension funds are looking to defease. But evidence of that increased allocation, you speak to someone like JANA, who are about the biggest institutional asset consultant, they'll tell you that it's very normal for a growing super fund to have between 5 and 10% of their portfolio in infrastructure. You've seen Aussie super funds increase their allocations to direct investments, which include infrastructure, fairly considerably over the last few years. And you're seeing a situation where a lot of the early investors on the institutional side, pension funds and superannuation funds such as MTAA, as an example, are increasing their allocations at the same time as a lot of super funds who didn't participate in the first wave are also now looking to play catch-up. Those early adopters have had a very positive experience in their first 10 years of engagement in the asset class, and that's being reflected in increased allocations. The funds management industry surrounding infrastructure assets and investing has grown dramatically, particularly, again, over the last 3 or 4 years. Investment banks traditionally played a fairly finite role in infrastructure as an asset class. They provided financial advice into deals, and they also tended to provide debt underwriting or debt arranging services. Again, over the last 3 to 5 years, you've seen investment banks evolve their participation in the asset class to a full end-to-end model, where they're looking to originate, they're looking to finance, looking to provide debt advisory, they'll warehouse it, they'll repackage it, and then they'll try and create a sort of funds management stream off the back of that. So investment banks have really evolved their level of participation in the asset class. This is one of the few asset classes where Australians are actually an exporter of best practice to the rest of the world. I mean, the asset class really began here in this country. And you've seen a few trends, again, over the last 3 to 5 years. You've seen all of the big incumbent Australian managers set up offshore presence. So, Macquarie, Hastings, AMP Capital, all setting up offshore presence in infrastructure investing. You've also seen a lot of US and European banks and funds managers who've looked to enter the asset class recruit a lot of Aussie expertise. So, you look at, big organisations like Citigroup who've established a presence in infrastructure investing, headed up by an Australian. It's hard to walk into a meeting anywhere in the world surrounding a deal on infrastructure and not hear an Australian accent somewhere in the room. So, infrastructure funds management is actually a real good news story as far as, best practice export of skills from Australia to the rest of the world. S&P estimate there were 27 new infrastructure funds launched in 2006 and that there's currently somewhere between 100 and 150 billion of committed equity looking for opportunities in infrastructure investing around the world. One of the other trends you've seen as evidence of growth in the asset class has been the increased securitisation of the asset class into listed markets. So, you look at the ASX 200, infrastructure and utility securities, about 1% of market cap in June 2002, grown fivefold, over that last 5 years. You've also seen increased securitisation of the asset class in global markets as well, not to as dramatic an extent, but certainly, quite a dramatic increase. Along with that increased securitisation, you have seen the development of a variety of indices that are designed to track the performance of listed infrastructure securities. S&P have got indices out there, UBS have got indices out there, Macquarie and FTSE have got indices out there, broken down by both geographical sub-indices and also sectoral sub-indices. A couple of interesting things that flow off this, certainly evidence that interest in the asset class is growing. From our perspective, we think there's actually some serious issues with the indices that have been created. We think that they are either too broad, i.e. they include assets and companies that in our definition are actually not infrastructure assets and companies, or they're too narrow. They are strictly focused on areas of traditional transport type infrastructure assets and exclude areas like transmission and distribution assets in utilities that are a very valid subsector in the infrastructure universe. So we actually think that all of the indices that are out there at the moment fail to adequately capture a definition of what we think infrastructure actually is, and that's led us to a point where we've created our own index that we sort of are looking to manage listed components and listed portfolios against. The last big evidence, if you like, that this asset class is becoming more front of mind is the fact that we have now seen in the last, again, 2 or 3 years, development of products that are specifically designed and focused on the retail market. So opening up infrastructure opportunities to the retail market for the first time. Those products to date have been largely focused on building portfolios of listed infrastructure securities. There are a number of managers out there who offer products that are focused around building, either regional or global portfolios of listed infrastructure securities. We think that it's evolving and that the next generation of products is beginning to emerge and that next generation of products is going to combine listed infrastructure securities with unlisted infrastructure exposure. And we think that evolution actually is very positive to the extent it is getting closer to delivering, the broader retail market with the best of both worlds in terms of the characteristics that listed infrastructure securities possess and also the characteristics that unlisted infrastructure investments possess. And I'll go into that in some more detail. So I've spoken about this concept of defining what infrastructure actually is. For us, when we apply our definition of whether an asset actually fits into an infrastructure definition, it's got to possess a number of things. You wouldn't guess looking at this slide, though. Okay. We're talking about assets that either provide or facilitate the provision of essential services in an economy. Now, that is interesting from a number of perspectives. We're talking about things that have very low demand elasticity to both price and to economic activity or traditional drivers of share market performance. That demand elasticity means you end up having quite predictable, quite stable cash flows coming out of these businesses. You know, irrespective of whether the economy is booming or not booming, people need to turn on the lights, people need to cook. So, you know, for a gas or an electricity distribution or transmission business, you're quite protected from the vagaries of economic activity. Inelasticity to price, again, a very important characteristic. I mean, you look at a toll road, and you know we've owned toll roads for long periods of time, and you know we've had a couple of experiences where, you know, tolls have gone up on roads and the number of cars using the road the next day was higher than the day before. So we tend to have demand profiles that are very inelastic to price, and that reflects this essential service concept. There are more. There we go. We're talking about assets that operate in highly regulated environments. So this creates either monopolies or very high barriers to entry in terms of competition to these assets. Again, if you're talking about an electricity distribution network, you are the only operator in that specific geographic area that is that you know has the right or has the area to distribute electricity. So you are a monopoly. As a result of that, you operate in a regulated environment where someone is telling you what you can charge for your services. And a major city airport is another very interesting natural monopoly. You know, nothing that's precluding someone else from coming along, but the amount of land that you need to create a major metropolitan airport means that if you are an incumbent, you tend to have a fairly monopolistic position in what you do. And again, this you know, this regulated nature, this high barrier to entry, all sort of feeds through to secure and fairly predictable cash flows. I've mentioned the fact we're talking about very long duration assets here, very suitable to match out long duration liability streams. You know, when we purchase a road or we purchase an airport, we're purchasing an asset that we have the right to own and the right to manage for anywhere between 50 and 100 years. So very long duration cash flows that you're purchasing when you're going into this asset class. Looking forward to getting through this slot. Okay. We're talking about revenues and cash flow streams that are either explicitly or implicitly linked or indexed to inflation. Again, in a toll road environment, just as an example, the concession deed that sits around a toll road typically limits your increase of pace of toll to increase in pace of inflation. If you have a gas distribution network, the regulator will allow you to increase your tariff in line with inflation. That's very interesting to the extent that, you know, it creates an environment where these assets are very good inflation hedges. So they're very good generators of real returns and preservers of real value. Assets that we define in the world of infrastructure tend to cost a lot of money to build or buy, but they tend to cost not a lot of money to run in an ongoing sense. Again, you get lots of free cash flow that tends to be spun out of these assets. You talk about a mature toll road. You might be running at an EBITDA margin of anywhere between 75 or 80%. So you might cost you billions of dollars to buy the asset up front, but your OPEX after you own it is A, limited in size, and B, very predictable and not particularly volatile. So again, this predictability of cash flow and predictability of income stream that flows out of these assets. Lastly, but not leastly, you tend to be talking about assets that have quite low levels of counterparty payment risk. So a lot of times you're contracting directly with the government, and so your counterparty is a AA or a AAA rated entity, particularly in the areas of social infrastructure, where you will build and you will own a hospital, and effectively, so long as that hospital is available for use, the government's paying you an availability charge. So your counterparty is a AAA rated entity. In the case of a toll road, you know, you might have 125,000 customers a day. If one or two of those customers don't pay their toll, it has very limited impact on your overall revenue stream. So your counterparty payment and credit risk is quite strong, in this asset class. So these are the key characteristics that assets need to possess to be defined as infrastructure in our world and our definition of the asset class. On the flip side, what are the key risks in this asset class? The major key risk is an increase in real interest rates. So I spoke about the fact that these assets are very powerful and very effective inflation hedges. You are talking about assets that are quite highly leveraged, so these tend to be financed with a relatively high degree of debt. Increases in the nominal rate of interest that are matched by an increase in inflation don't tend to hurt you because, again, you've got cash flows and revenue streams that are inflation-linked on the other side. But where you've got an increase in real interest rates, so rates going up without a corresponding increase in inflation, that can lead to two things. It can deteriorate the cash flows that are coming out of the asset, given that you are in a leveraged environment. And it can also, given the way these assets are valued, which tends to be a long-term discounted cash flow basis where you're taking future cash flows and discounting them back to a net present value. The key determinant in a DCF-based valuation environment is, of course, the discount rate you're using to value those future assets. If that discount rate is rising and it's not being offset by an increase in revenue, then that is going to impact value and impact performance. These assets can be quite exposed to exogenous shocks, regulatory, political risk. The owners of the Cross City Tunnel would probably, spend some time talking to you about that. Even in things like airports, you'll sort of recall that, September 11 in 2001, had a pretty sharp impact on the number of passengers that were travelling by air and the number of passengers travelling through airports. The interesting thing is, whilst these assets, and I'll use the airport example, are quite exposed to these one-off exogenous shocks, in airports, we've been through a number of them now. We've been through September 11, we've been through the Ansett collapse, we've been through SARS, we've been through bird flu. They tend to have pretty sharp one-off downward shocks, but typically all of that shock is recovered within a pretty short period. So, we've seen three or four of these on Melbourne Airport, which is one of the assets that we own. And our passenger numbers are back to above pre-shock levels, typically within anywhere between 8 to 18 months. So they tend to recover fairly quickly. I mentioned the fact we are sitting in a leveraged environment, typically, when we're owning infrastructure investments. So what you're really trading off is this lower level of operating risk, so quite predictable cash flows coming out of the business, trading it off for higher levels of financing risk, because you are financing the acquisition of the asset using a degree of debt. And you are also exposed to these exogenous risks. So there's some of the inherent asset characteristics. And again, the title of this talk is really, making the leap or the transition from those inherent asset characteristics to the investment characteristics that come out for someone depending on the way these assets are parcelled up and delivered through to the investor. And we believe that packaging is key, and that packaging is vital in terms of delivering effectively those sort of positive characteristics through to an investor. So in infrastructure, we're talking about a couple of things. We're talking about these predictable and fairly stable levels of inherent cash flow coming in out of an asset. We're talking about inflation and interest rate hedge cash flows and returns. And we're talking about relatively high and predictable levels of running yield as a result of the fact that we've got this predictable level of cash flow and income stream. However, the way it's delivered, whether it's parceled up and put through to an investor in a listed or an unlisted structure, can actually be quite an important factor in either preserving, diluting, or altering these inherent characteristics, and we'll sort of go into that. If you take a look at unlisted infrastructure, so portfolios of unlisted infrastructure exposures tend to provide quite pure exposure to the asset class. So when I say pure, these are not businesses that tend to have a lot of moving parts. They tend to evolve and change at a relatively glacial pace. So we're not talking about businesses that are either doing very well one day and very poorly the next. They tend to move in incremental, slow manners in terms of the inherent business performance. You're talking about very stable and uncorrelated investment performance, and I'll show you some data from infrastructure equity fund is our flagship vehicle in the wholesale space, unlisted vehicle. Been around now for 12 years, very uncorrelated performance, with mainstream asset classes and quite low levels of volatility in that performance. And in the unlisted world at the moment, you can get exposure to a broader range of subsectors with infrastructure than you can typically access through the listed space. Social infrastructure is a classic example of that, or, you know, traditional PPPs in the social space, quite difficult to access, you know, through the listed market. There is a trade-off, however, and that trade-off is illiquidity. You know, infrastructure assets are inherently illiquid. They're not the sort of assets, you know, given their multi-billion dollar enterprise values that you can liquidate overnight. So they are inherently illiquid. And because they are big ticket assets and investors require big tickets to sort of play, the scale of the capital commitment that an investor requires to construct a diversified portfolio of exposures, particularly if you're trying to do it on a global basis, has been beyond the reach of sort of retail investors. So, again, to give you an example of that stability of returns, this is the one-year rolling return of IEF, or Infrastructure Equity Fund, since its commencement. You know, as I said, it's a 12-year track record now. It's generated positive one-year returns on 94% of observations between, you know, September 1996, which is 1 year after the fund began, and June 2007, a very sort of predictable and relatively stable investment profile across that period. Now, listed infrastructure really arose to try and address some of those inherent, you know, issues, if you like, in unlisted infrastructure. Listed infrastructure provides liquidity to what is an inherently illiquid asset class. It allows people to implement and change their portfolio decisions in a relatively timely basis. Right? If you want to sell shares, you know, in Connect East, you know, you can do that easily. If you want to buy shares in MAP or MIG, you can do that very, very easily. It's also been a tool to allow people to build diversified portfolios with smaller capital requirements than you would have needed to build a corresponding diversified portfolio in the unlisted space. But again, there's a trade-off. And that trade-off is the volatility of investment performance that is inherent in owning listed infrastructure. And it's the equity market beta that you, by definition, buy whenever you buy a listed infrastructure stock. So again, true diversification is about finding uncorrelated beta. You know, listed infrastructure has had some issues in delivering that, and we'll talk about that in some more detail as well. So again, you know, these are the trade-offs that investors have been forced to embrace in looking at either unlisted or listed as a solution for building a portfolio for clients. Some of the return correlations, again, you know, this is 5 years of data to 30 June this year, just to evidence that sort of correlation issue. You look at we've used IEF as our proxy for unlisted infrastructure here. You can see quite lowly correlated both with Aussie equities and also with, you know, a listed infrastructure index. You can see that the listed infrastructure index, again, much more highly correlated with, you know, with a mainstream equities portfolio. And again, not surprising from a couple of perspectives. One, you are talking about, you know, securities that are listed on stock markets, so it's not surprising they're correlated with everything else that's listed on stock market. And B, you're talking in the mainstream indices, and I'll come into this in a bit more detail. Securities or indices that include exposure to things that don't fulfil certainly our definition of infrastructure and therefore, in an underlying business sense, behave far more like a normal company. And again, therefore, it's not surprising given that its performance and its exposure is more highly correlated to a normal industrial, that its performance in the market should also be more highly correlated with an industrial. A snapshot there of you know, historical asset return and volatility coming out. Again, we've used IEF as our proxy for unlisted infrastructure. Over the 5 years to 30 June, slightly lower return than listed infrastructure, but a far lower level of volatility of return, therefore, you know, slightly higher reward-to-risk ratio. So, again, I'm not using this to try and say one's better than the other. I'm just trying to point out, I guess, the strengths and weaknesses, you know, that each possesses. I've mentioned a couple of times the problems that we've got with the mainstream listed infrastructure indices that are available in the market today. As I said, we believe they're either far too broad or far too narrow in fulfilling a valid definition of what infrastructure actually is. If you look at the very broad indices that are out there, they're heavily, heavily weighted to things like merchant electricity generating businesses and vertically integrated utility businesses. Now, if you think about, you know, a merchant electricity generating business, typically you're talking about a business that is producing electricity and dispatching it into a market or a grid over which it has no price, no control over the price. So your only thing you're in control of is the cost at which you can produce electricity. You are a price taker in when you dispatch that electricity into the network. So again, in one sense, more akin to a commodity market than it is to an infrastructure market. You talk about vertically integrated businesses that will control, utility businesses that control everything from merchant generating all the way through to the retail, you know, the customer-facing part of an electricity business. Again, probably the two most volatile parts of the whole value chain in energy. You know, in our definition or our characteristics that we define infrastructure by, those things don't fulfil a valid definition of infrastructure. I've mentioned the fact that you've got very, very narrow indices out there, again, that will contain, you know, traditional transport-related infrastructure and a little bit of social infrastructure, but do not include aspects of the utility space that we believe are, in fact, just classic infrastructure definitions and characteristics. So, you know, transmission and distribution assets of, you know, gas and electricity, you know, water communications that we think are, you know, are valid. So that's led us to a point where, given we were very unhappy with the indices that were out there, we constructed our own. So we've built a customised infrastructure index that screens a universe of stocks globally against our definition and our characteristics for infrastructure, you know, to come up with a screened universe that is more consistent with what we believe it is. If you take a look at that, the characteristics of that index and what it's generated over the last 5 years to 30 June, and compare that with one of the mainstream infrastructure indices that are out there, again, you'll see slightly lower return, certainly much lower risk, and a slightly higher dividend yield. And that is just reflecting the fact that our index and our universe is more focused around what I would call classic defensive infrastructure and utility plays, as opposed to this broader definition that captures, you know, we believe, assets and companies that are far more akin to a traditional industrial stock than a true infrastructure exposure. So we've spoken about this dilemma of either being forced to embrace, you know, the illiquidity of unlisted infrastructure, but, you know, the stability and the low correlation, the low volatility that has, or embracing listed infrastructure and looking at the sort of strengths and weaknesses that it has. As I mentioned, you know, we believe the next stage in the evolution of product and delivery of infrastructure to investors is actually going to be about capturing the best of both worlds. So, again, to try and sort of draw this out, we've just created a number of theoretical portfolios here, beginning with a portfolio that's just equally split between bonds and shares. We've got portfolio two, which adds 10% unlisted infrastructure exposure, equally funded from shares and bonds. We've done the same thing in Portfolio 3 with listed infrastructure, and then we've done the same thing in Portfolio 4 by blending an exposure that is half unlisted infrastructure and half listed infrastructure exposure. And you can see there, in terms of, you know, building a portfolio, you've been able, from certainly Portfolio 1, to decrease your risk at the same time as increasing your overall return. And on a reward-to-risk basis, certainly supports the value of, you know, blending different types of infrastructure exposure. If you take a look again at sort of pulling that back a little bit from how it fits into an overall portfolio and just looking at what it does to combine a listed and an unlisted exposure, and again, the proxies we've used here are IEF as the unlisted infrastructure exposure and the AMP Capital Global Index as a listed infrastructure exposure. Again, combining those two solutions into a portfolio, you know, in that 5-year period to 30 June, gave you a much more efficient looking solution on any way you want to sort of, you know, measure it, either reward to risk. You know, it's pretty powerful as a true diversifier, rather than having to choose one or the other.
Please join me in thanking Paul for his presentation.